The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My Buddhist name is Rikyu Boku Zen. It's given to me by my teacher, and my Zen teacher. And he inscribed in my rakusu, it's kind of like a robe, a metaphor or some kind of poem to describe the meaning of that name. And it said, "The medicine that can cure all ills. Now I can understand the spring rain on the river at night." So I'm very grateful for this practice. This practice has brought me over the years much peace that I would never have dreamed possible. Access to beauty, access to calm, access to happiness, access to love, compassion, ease. And I think that's what draws all of us to this practice from the beginning meditation, the first meditation that we do. So what is the medicine that cures all ills? I think when we meditate this style of meditation, we enter the calm of our bodies and the calm of our breathing, and we have access to something that we didn't have access to before. Something bigger than us. We have a sense of an oceanic awareness that can see but is removed from all the conditions that keep appearing. Probably when you were meditating today, you came in with certain conditions, and those were what kept coming up for you, and what the waves of the ocean, they would keep coming up. Today, these are the conditions, right now, these are the conditions, and these conditions will change. And when you meditate this evening, if you meditate, there will be a different conditions, different waves. But they'll relax into the ocean, then they'll stir up again, then relax again. So we say that we practice awareness. Sometimes it's called my true home. Sometimes it's called the ocean. Sometimes it's called big mind seeing small mind. I was taught in the Zen tradition, three kinds of Buddhas. There's the Nirmanakaya Buddha. That's the Buddha body. You are all Nirmanakaya Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha was Nirmanakaya Buddha. There's Sambhogakaya Buddha. Suzuki Roshi, the teacher then, was very poetic. He described the Sambhogakaya Buddha as eternal, an eternal body, something that is always here with us. And something that we have access to. It's not this body, it's an eternal body. It's a big body that we can sense. So I like this Sambhogakaya Buddha in a way better than a reference to awareness, because it gives a sense of magic to the moment. And we take refuge. This is what we take refuge in Sambhogakaya Buddha. We take refuge in awareness. That's our vow. This is the medicine that cures our ills. This is what allows us to see, to understand the spring rain on the river, to see, to understand. But it's not so easy, is it? The fires of our karma are very strong. There's a friend of mine who has a little boy, and his little boy was in a toy shop, very small, at 3 years old. He was in a toy shop with him, and he said, "Daddy, I want that toy." And his dad said, "I'm sorry, you can't have that toy." And then the little boy said, "No, Daddy, you don't understand. I really want that toy." And the dad said, "No, you don't understand. You can't have that toy." And then the son said, little boy said, "No, Daddy, you don't understand. I really want that toy." And so it was like he wasn't really saying he had to have that toy. He just wanted the dad to understand how he felt. He wanted the dad to understand, "This is a really strong feeling right now." And the dad said, "Oh yes, now I understand," and took his hand and he left. But it's not so easy for us. That's a small child whose attention is easily averted. But we can identify with the power of his desire. We hold on to our desires and we get very worked up about them, and we get very angry at the dad who wouldn't give us the toy, and we get jealous of the little girl who got that toy, and we think there's something wrong with me that I didn't get that toy. I'm not a worthy person, otherwise I would have gotten that toy. I'm inadequate, and on and on and on. So our minds can proliferate around our desires for recognition, for praise, for sensual desire, for success, for all kinds of things. And when we don't get those things, when we get them, we got them, it's over, we want another one. So it's endless. But when we don't get them, we can become very, very upset. We can become so upset and proliferate so much around it that we can become very miserable, and it's like it's all crowding in on us, and it's like it's never going to happen. We're never going to get that. And we start, you know, we have identities about ourselves, about how we will never get what we want, and how it's always going to be this way. And it can get so claustrophobic, so hemmed in, so bad, that human beings actually sometimes kill themselves. The power of this desire can get so strong that it can actually override our very powerful instinct to live. I'd like to talk today about one of the most painful experiences that human beings have, just one little aspect of this piece, and that is around the desire to be liked by other people, the desire to be part of the group, to not be rejected, the pain of rejection. I think all of us have felt like we don't belong. I think all of us have felt like we're an outsider, that we're not liked, that we'll never be liked, there's something wrong with us. Well, you're not alone. This is not some phenomenon in Redwood City in the 21st century. If you think you have troubles with your family, the Buddha had a cousin, Devadatta, who hated him. He was jealous of him. He spread terrible rumors about him. He turned large numbers of monks away from him. And he tried to kill him. We all have difficulties with people, with friends, with co-workers, with bosses, with family members, with partners, with spouses. I've written down a few quotes from Psalms, again, to show you how this is not just here and now. This is a historical. This is in our DNA. This is from Psalms. How many are my tormentors? How many rise up against me? How many say of me, there's no hope for him? And then she entreats God to rise up and embrace me. Shatter the jaws, break the teeth of my tormentor, that no twisted words can be formed in his mouth. Psalm 5, vindictive. Lend me into rightness against the force of my envy. Straighten me, for their mouths know not a single sincere word. Inside they are full of deception. Their throat are graves. Ever feel like that? Psalm 12. Between neighbor and neighbor, subtle lies weave entangling threads. Cut off, and she asks God to cut off all their nattering lips. Psalm 22. That's the desire for extinguishment, by the way. Psalm 22. Utterly alone, I am cast out of the circle. A worm, a living reproach, scorned and despised, even less than despised, unheard, unseen, unacknowledged, denied, and all who encounter me revile me with cynic laughter, shaking their heads, parting their nattering lips, mocking, for I am hounded by my isolation. We experience blame and rejection from other people. People don't like us. People blame us. People disregard us. People don't think we're important. People say hurtful things to us. This may be the most consistent problem that we human beings have to deal with, if not the biggest problem. So how do we practice with this brand of suffering? The first thing we need to do is restrain ourselves and feel the feeling. We need to step back, pause the minute if we sense these feelings coming on. Pause. Turn toward the feeling. My teacher said, turn toward your fear. Feel the feeling. Be brave. Be strong. It's not going to kill you. And allow your awareness to shine on this. Take refuge in awareness, medicine. Be patient. And then wisdom will come forth. Wisdom will tell us, wow, this is going to change. Look around. This is going to change. In an hour, this is going to be completely different. Tomorrow, this is going to be completely different. So patience. Feel the contraction. Feel the pain. Feel the vice grip on the heart sometimes. And be patient. Ajahn Sucitto, in his book on Parami, said, being willing to meet the flood takes great heart. It's not easy. And this won't make the suffering go away, but it's committing ourselves not to living by our karma, like cutting off nattering lips and so forth, But it's living by vow, taking refuge in Sambhogakaya Buddha. This immediately short-circuits the advancement of the karma by turning back. And then the karmic pathways advance again. We step back again. They advance again. We step back again, and on and on. And by strengthening our presence in this way, the suffering does pass more quickly. Presence reasserts itself more quickly. We meditators are more resilient. Have you noticed that? Because of our practice, how soon things go away for us. Ajahn Chah said that being a monk is to know about letting go, but being unable to do so 90% of the time. So we need to be patient. And like one of those pop-up games where you smash the frog, I don't know if you've ever seen those things, you smash these frogs and then they pop right back up again and you smash them, you get points every time you can knock one down, smash one down, but they keep popping up. Well, frogs are a symbol for awareness in Buddhism. So our awareness keeps popping right back up. It's very resilient. So turning toward the feeling, feeling it, knowing this is one set of feelings, but there are billions of feelings going on here. It's another perspective. I'm going to go over a little bit because I just want to tell you this one other little piece that I think is important. So one of my dear teachers is fond of this saying, if it's about me, there is suffering. If it's about others, there is no suffering. So this is skill and means. This is becoming that works. If someone hurts us, we can pause, restrain ourselves, shine the light of awareness, get some space, and instead of focusing on our small self, our victim, think about the person that's doing that. Think about, you know, in the way we're detached now, it's not about us anymore. It's about the person, like, wow, did I do something there? What did I do? Think about, why would that person react that way? He's a human being. Why would they react that way to me? Maybe I was unskillful in the way I treated that person or said something that, you know, maybe I thought it was okay, but it just didn't work. So that can inform us to do it differently next time. Maybe we want to even apologize to that person. Maybe not. Maybe that's not going to work. But there's no law that says you can't completely take it back, something you've said or done. You can go to that person, it's possible, and say, I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to offend you. I hope you can forgive me. Give a gift. Give a compliment. But the main thing is aligning ourselves with the feeling of awareness. And the feeling of awareness is part of our vow, is compassion. Part of our vow is it's what's aligned with awareness are the limitlessness of awareness, or the limitless mature human emotions. This is where we also take refuge, in our kindness, in our compassion. For our own benefit, we take refuge out of our small self and into caring for other human beings. So thank you.